chapter 11. So this is the last of the three Israel chapters. 9, 10, and 11. This is, so after he's talked about Israel didn't believe, and they had all the stuff, and they didn't believe it, and they need the gospel, and I'm dying inside that they didn't accept the gospel. What does that mean? You know, that Israel, Gentiles came to faith to make Israel jealous. And if Israel falling made the Gentiles saved, so to speak, then what's going to happen when Israel is saved? It's going to be like the whole world is going to be on fire. But that'll be just before Jesus comes back. So I hope it's today. So 11, we're going to get to what is this going to mean for Israel and what does this mean for us? And this is where the famous olive tree comes from. All right, so let's do chapter 11, 1 through 4.
I'm Satan. Has God cast away his people? Certainly not. For I also am an Israelite, of the seed of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. God has not cast away his people whom he foreknew. Or do you not know what the scripture says of Elijah, how he pleads with God against Israel, saying, Lord, they have killed your prophets and torn down your altars, and I alone am left, and they seek my life. But what does the divine response say to him?
I have reserved for myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to Baal.
Pause there. So the question then, is Israel permanently cut off? This was a thinking, it still is a thinking in a lot of churches, that God's done with Israel, the church is the new Israel, the Jews have been cast off. We're going to get to that in a minute. People still think that way. In the early centuries, a lot of the fathers of the church wrote that Israel was done. We don't want any of that Jewish stuff anymore. They're done. They're cast off. The Reformation, Luther said, you know, if I baptize a Jew, I'm going to tie rope. I'm going to tie rocks to him and throw him off the bridge. How the church can be anti-Semitic is beyond me, but, you know, it's happened. I mean, the Inquisition burned Jews, and Ferdinand and Isabella threw them out of Spain in 1492, and England threw them out in 11-something, and so the idea, is Israel permanently cut off? Well, if God cut them off, then who cares about them anymore? So he said, did God cut them off? He says, certainly not. No. Certainly not. Certainly not, the exclamation point. Then he points out, I'm an Israelite. So this is, you know, there's one other place where Paul talks about how not only is he an Israelite, but tells us what tribe he's from. The tribe of Benjamin, that's in Philippians chapter 3. He says, I'm from the tribe of Benjamin, I'm a Pharisee of Pharisees, I'm a Hebrew of Hebrews, I, you know, did all the stuff, and now I count that all as loss, I count that all as rubbish compared to knowing Christ. So he says, I'm an Israelite, I'm from the tribe of Benjamin. So this is really important to me, and God has not cut us off. And then he goes to Elijah and he quotes from 1 Kings 19. Now remember, this is in 1 Kings 18, Elijah takes on the prophets of Baal at Mount Carmel. And they have there's Elijah against 450 pagan priests. And so they have their little contest where they say, let's see who's the real God. Will offer sacrifices, and without going through all that, Baal, of course, doesn't respond to the pagan priests, and God comes down with fire and burns up the altar, even burns the stones of the little altar that Elijah had made. But then he ran away because Queen Jezebel was going to kill him, so he ran away. So he gets down way down in the desert by Beersheba, and you get to chapter 9. That's like 150 miles. He didn't just run like, you know, 20 miles. He went like 150 miles away because he was so scared. So So he's a great prophet. He does this big miracle, but then he's scared. So he runs away. And he says to God, you just kill me. I'm the only one left. You know, I'm the only one. They've killed your prophets. They've torn down your altars. I'm the only one left. And now they want to kill me. So why don't you just go ahead and kill me? So God smacks him around and says, dude, you're not the only one. There's 7,000 other men who've not bowed the knee. Okay. There were 3 million total Israelites. So I don't know how many of those were men. Say 1 million of them were men. Only 7,000 were faithful. It's a really little remnant. 7,000. There's always a remnant. Like, we're the remnant now. There's always...
I was just thinking that.
Yeah, we're the remnant now. I mean, we're in a culture where we're the weirdos now. Yeah, we're the weirdos. We're the intolerant ones. We're the, you know, I mean, up to now it's just been eye rolling, but now it's getting to be more aggressive. And so there's always a remnant that's present. So Paul says, there's always a remnant of Israelites that are going to be faithful. I'm a believer. The apostles are believers. The other guys were believers. You know, all the evangelists that were going around at this time were Jewish believers because Gentiles were just starting to come in. So he says, there's always a remnant. You can't say, oh, there's nobody left. Like, we can't sit here and say, we're the only Christians in the world that are left. Because we don't know there's 120 more over there and 5,000 more over there and... So, how about 5 and 6?
And so then, at this present time, there is a remnant according to the election of grace. And if by grace, there is no longer of works, otherwise grace is no longer grace. But if it is of works, it is no longer grace. Otherwise, work is no longer work.
So, you got this remnant, and it's an election according to grace. It isn't from the law. In other words, if you're a Hebrew, you can't just say, well, you know, you guys over there can do the Jesus thing if you want. I kind of believe in it too, but I'm going to do the law now too. And, you know, I'll get back to you guys on that. It says, no, it's by grace. It's not from the law. And it's not by works. Or else grace isn't grace if you have to earn it. So we know that the definition is grace is unmerited favor. You get what you don't deserve. So you don't, God can say, you know what? You've done enough things in your life where you're going to be damned. And there's nothing you can do to fix it. But he says, no, that you've done a lot of horrible things in your life, but... through Jesus, you can be saved. So just come here. You know, like the prodigal son. Why am I laying in the mud here with these pigs when I could go back to my father's house? I'd rather be a slave at my father's house than be here working with these pigs. And the kid shows up all smelly and disgusting, and he puts the robe on him and the ring and everything. Because even though we're filthy and disgusting and we've been living with pigs, he puts a robe on us. So it says, you know, it's by grace. And otherwise, grace isn't grace. And even the works that you do, see what he's getting at here is what he mentioned before. Because you have grace, you do the works. Because you have faith, you do the works. So if you do the works and hope you're getting some points, then grace isn't grace. Because then you're trying to earn it. And you should do the works. You know, it's, so what he's saying is because there's grace, that's the key, of course. Grace is always the key because we get what we don't deserve. And if you're, because everything we do, even the good things we do are tainted by sin, right? And they don't know all my examples, so you have to put up with it. But, you know, if Ted and I are walking down the street and we see a homeless guy, and I reach in my pocket and I take out a $5 bill and I say, here. He reaches in his pocket and takes out a dollar bill and gives it to the guy. I can look at it and think to myself, I gave him $5. He only gave him one. I did five times more than you know, if you think like that, that's not, you don't get points. He says, our good works are like a pile of filthy rags. I mean, we say, look at what I've done. And he says, oh, that's nice. You gave the guy $1 once? Oh, I'm impressed. You went to church again Sunday? Oh, I'm impressed. Saved by grace, but works are important. You know, you can't just say, well, once I got grace, then I don't have to worry about it. Because you want to do something. All right, now how about 7 through 10?
Well, then, Israel has not obtained what it seeks, but the elect have obtained it, and the rest were blinded. Just as it is written, God has given them a spirit of stupor, eyes that they should not see, and ears that they should not hear, to this very day. And David says, let their table become a snare and a trap, a stumbling block and a recompense to them. Let their eyes be darkened so that they do not see and bow down their back always. Mm.
So Israel hasn't obtained what it seeks. What did Israel want to do? They wanted to be with God. They were supposed to be righteous. They were supposed to be following the law. They couldn't do it. Then Messiah came. Didn't accept that either. So they didn't get what they sought through either way, either through the law or through Messiah, because they screwed up the law and they missed the Messiah. But he says, but the elect have obtained it. The people who are supposed to understand it. The people who understand it get what's going on. And so by grace, they're in the remnant. The rest, the more hardened you get, the more blinded you get. And that's why, you know, you remember the thing where Jesus said, well, you know, I speak in parables because if I tell it plainly, people are going to understand it, but I don't want them to understand it. They have to figure it out for themselves. And it sounds pretty harsh, but the issue is if you're not open to truth, you're going to get even less stuff. You know, if you have a little bit and you're willing to do something, that's good. If you say, you know what, I don't want to do any of that stuff, your hardness gets even harder. And so they have a stupor. Their eyes don't see it. Their ears don't hear it. Isaiah talked about this. Isaiah 29:10. You know, he's talking about how Messiah is going to speak in parables. And then he says, you know, the parables are going to make people not understand what he says. And that sounds kind of harsh. You know, when we read parables, we kind of get what it is because we're tuned into it. But your average person on the street, you know, what's that mean? You know, like if you see back when the prodigal son parable starts, it says the common people are listening to every word he's saying. The religious leaders are muttering, it says. What's he talking about? Son gets the money and goes. What kind of stupid story is this? That son should be punished. But they're not listening to the story. And so because they're hard, they don't get the story. So when the story's over, they say, that's the stupidest story I ever heard. The father should have just taken that kid and said, too bad you left. Get out of here. They don't get the parable. And so God makes them more blind than they already are. And so here are those great quotes from two Isaiah passages and two Psalms. Okay, now about 11 and 12.
I say then, have they stumbled that they should fall? Certainly not. But through their fall, to provoke them to jealousy, salvation has come to the Gentiles. Now, if their fall is riches for the world, and their failure riches for the Gentiles, how much more their fullness?
Whew! So they fell, but they haven't totally fallen out. In other words, they can still be saved. And in a minute, he's going to tell you how they're going to be, that they're going to be saved. They can still be saved. And so the Gentiles have been brought to faith to make Israel jealous. Because people, it's hard for us to understand because we don't see the stark difference between Jew and Gentile that they would have seen. You know, you got a Jewish guy who works with you at work. You don't stand there and say, well, you're a Jew, I'm a Gentile. You know, and he doesn't say, I'm sorry, I'm not allowed to talk to you because you're a Gentile. Or, you know, that's not part of our life. But at this time, it was part of your life. You're a Jew or you're a Gentile. And there's no mixing. I mean, in our days, for example, if you fall in love with a Jewish girl and you take her home and say, we're going to get married, people might say, you know, at this time, you're going to marry who? You know, the Jewish parents say, what? Because there's a separation. So here, he says, the Gentiles come to faith in the Jewish Messiah. The Jews, who are the chosen people, say, what? What do they know about Messiahs? What do they know about the true God? They're pagans. Why are they worshiping the God of Israel? They went a little bit off the rocker here with this Messiah thing. But why are they worshiping the God of Israel? They're supposed to be pagans. So they think, well, how did that happen? It's supposed to make them jealous. It makes them think, why in the world is this happening? I had Jewish friends I witnessed to forever that would say, well, you know, Jesus came to bring the Gentiles to know the true God. But then they misunderstood his message and they made him a God. So if they hadn't done the Christianity thing, everything would have been fine. I said, then I would say, so we'd all be Jews then. Yes. They can't understand. So if their fall means the Gentiles are saved, when they come to faith, the whole world's going to be rich. Because then everybody's going to be united. You know, 2 Corinthians, Paul says, God chooses to reconcile the world to himself through Christ. There's no other way to do it. He doesn't reconcile his world by all joining hands and singing songs together, or, you know, like, Auntie, we just all get along kind of thing. It's through Christ that the world's reconciled to God. And it doesn't matter if you're Jew or Gentile. You know, there's Christians who think, well, Israel has their own covenant. As long as they follow their own covenant. Well, and there's Jews who say, well, you know, you Christians are, it's great that you follow the real God, but, you know, maybe he'll overlook all his our stuff and, you know, you got a chance. So it's interesting because when you think about it, Paul's preaching. Every place he goes to the synagogue first, gets rejected, then he preaches to the Gentiles. So the Gentiles accept the Messiah and the Jews don't. I mean, in his mind, that's got to be, as he said, you know, we saw last time how frustrated he gets. I got so frustrated by this because these are my own flesh and blood people and they don't get what I'm talking about. I mean, they're a small community. Like, you know, I can't worry about, you know, is every Italian or Italian-American going to know the Lord? And because there's, you know, tens of millions of them. But Jews are always a very small group. You know, it's you know in your community who knows what everybody's doing. So he says it makes them crazy. And then when they see people like us, you know, reading the Torah, they're like thinking, why in the world do you care about that? Well, because it's about the Messiah. Oh. Or why do you care about the prophets? Oh, because they talk about Jesus. Oh. A lot of eye rolling and groaning goes on, believe me. 13 through 15.
For I speak to you, Gentiles, inasmuch as I am an apostle to the Gentiles, I magnify my ministry. If by any means I may provoke to jealousy those who are my flesh and save some of them. For if their being cast away is the reconciling of the world, what will their acceptance be but life from the dead?
Yeah, so pause there. So he adds it again. If their rejection brings life to the world, when they come to faith too, it's going to be like rising from the dead. The whole world's going to rise from the dead. They're certainly going to rise from the dead. So he says, I'm talking to you Gentiles because I'm an apostle to the Gentiles. And I'm magnifying my ministry. Because if I can provoke more Jews to jealousy, if I can bring Jews to faith, great. If I can provoke them to jealousy, that's good too. Because they're my own flesh and blood. So he's made for this. He's made for this. You know, like when he's going to Damascus and then he's there blind and he can't see and Ananias comes and heals him. You know, the Lord tells Ananias, Saul is my special vessel to the Gentiles. He's specially made for that. And because he was the most zealous of all the Pharisees, he was advancing more than all the other Pharisees. You know, the law was everything to him. He becomes the apostle of grace and the apostle to the Gentiles. It's like a 180-degree flip. So that's what he's saying. If I could get them thinking about it, that's what I'm trying to do here. He's made for this. So Paul says, you know, this is my mission. This is what I do. And, you know, if we ever do 2 Corinthians, it's tough, you know. I get shipwrecked, I get beaten, I get stoned, I get left for dead, I get attacked by people, but I keep going. You know, we're afraid of being insulted by somebody. This guy got beaten, stoned, thrown out of cities, attacked. Lynch mobs came after him. And he said, yeah, thrown in prison. He said, yep, just keep going. Okay, so 16 through 18.
For if the first fruit is holy, the lump is also holy. And if the root is holy, so are the branches. And if some of the branches were broken off, and you, being a wild olive tree, were grafted in among them, and with them became a partaker of the root and fatness of the olive tree, do not boast against the branches. But if you do boast, remember that you do not support the root, but the root supports you.
So this is the famous olive tree. Now, everything's compared to an olive tree. Israel is the olive tree, the domestic olive. We Gentiles are wild olives, and now we're grafted into the tree. And as he points out, because we got grafted in, don't be criticizing and being snooty about the other branches, because it's the roots that are nourishing us. We don't talk against the roots. So when you say, who cares about all that Jewish stuff? Who cares about the Old Testament? You're talking against the roots. And the roots are what nourish you. Some of the branches, you know, the tree's still there. The roots are still there. The tree's still there. But now we're grafted in. The tree's important. The roots are very important. And the roots nourish the branches. So we're grafted, you know, I don't know anything about plants, but when you graft it in, it becomes part of the tree. Yeah. So the roots bring nourishment up into the branch. And that's, so that's us. We're the wild branch. And this is the opposite of what a farmer would do. Because what God's saying here is, I got my beautiful tree here, but I'm going to take you, the bad tree, and graft it into the good tree. I'm going to take you pagan Gentiles who now believe, and I'm going to put you in the tree. So they're taking the wild branch, putting it into the domestic thing. You wouldn't do that with grapes. You wouldn't grab a wild grape thing and graft it into a beautiful grapevine that was making good grapes. But that's what he's talking about happened. So we get grafted in. So the graft, of course, as the nourishment comes up from the roots, it nourishes the wild branch too. And then, of course, over time, we as the wild branch bear even better fruit than the rest of the tree. So if you say, hey, we're Christians, and so we're saved by grace because we believe in Jesus, but the Jews over there, They got their own law. They got their own covenant. So if they do that, no, we're one body. Or if a Jew comes to faith in Jesus, we don't say to him, well, okay, I'm glad you got the Jesus thing, but you better go back over there. No, because we're one body. Good point. There's not, like I always say on my TV shows, there's not two bodies, not a Jewish body and a Gentile body. Once you come to Jesus, there's one body. You know, we don't need like 58,000 denominations. We're one body. And so people quibble about a verse here and there and say, all right, that's fine, I'm leaving. I'm going to go over there and start my own church. And so pretty soon there's 28,000 denominations. And Jesus prayed that we all may be one. The blessing of Abraham comes to the Gentiles, basically. The blessing of Abraham's been fueling the olive tree all those centuries. And now we're grafted into that too. And even if you see the tree, well, some people look, I added it there, some people look at it as Christ being the tree and, you know, a tree of believers and non-believers are grafted in. You still have the roots of Judaism supporting the tree. But he points out the tree is Israel. But you can read commentaries about how the tree is Christ and you're grafted in. That doesn't quite match up with what he said, but that's okay. Talks about the first fruit. You know, Jesus rose from the dead on the Feast of First Fruits. Jesus didn't just randomly rise because it was Sunday. He rose because that was the Feast of First Fruits, and he's the first fruit of the resurrection. And what you do on the Feast of First Fruits is you take the barley grain, ripens at that time, and you take the first, always the best one, you take the ripened fruit and offer it to God. And if you do that, the whole rest of the crop is blessed. If you don't do that, then your crop's not blessed. So Christ, as the first fruit, is offered to the Father. The Father accepts it, so the whole crop is blessed, and that's us. Is that cool or what? When people say, who cares about Jewish holidays? Well, there's one reason to care about that one. Yeah, so the first fruit is holy, so the whole rest of it is holy. And the root is holy, then the branches get holy. And they're the roots. So don't boast against the branch. Don't boast against the branches, because the roots support you. And don't boast, don't think, I don't need the roots. You know, the tree over here can't say, I don't need the roots. So then he's going to go on, 19 through 24.
You will say then, branches were broken off that I might be grafted in. Well said. Because of unbelief, they were broken off. And you stand by faith. Do not be haughty, but fear. For if God did not spare the natural branches, he may not spare you either. Therefore, consider the goodness and severity of God. On those who fell, severity. But toward you, goodness, if you continue in his goodness. Otherwise, you also will be cut off. And they also, if they do not continue in unbelief, will be grafted in. For God is able to graft them in again. For if you were cut out of the olive tree, which is wild by nature, and were grafted contrary to nature into a cultivated olive tree, how much more will these, who are natural branches, be grafted into their own olive tree? Oh.
So if we're the olive, if we're the wild olive, and we got grafted in, the natural olive tree, the Jews that are cut off, if they want to be grafted back in, that'll be even easier. Because we're part of the tree originally. So we're grafted in. Supported by the roots, nourished by the roots. So if the wild ones can be grafted in, then the natural ones can certainly go back. So this is where, you know, without getting into a lot of detail, what happened after the time of Jesus, and then, of course, the Jews were exiled all over the place, And that's another thing, you know, you get from Deuteronomy. People were, when people violate the law, there's punishment. When they violate the law worse, there's more punishment. When they do something totally outrageous, then there's exile. So in 70 AD, they got scattered all over the world. And this is where what's called rabbinical Judaism came. Because there was no more priesthood. There was no high priest anymore. There were no kind of religious structures because they were all over the place. So the rabbis got to be important in each local place. Because there was not a central place like when they lived in Israel and had the temple. So then the rabbis got together and made all kind of rulings about things. And one of the things they had to rule on was, now what do? We can't atone for sin anymore. Because you only do the sacrifices in the temple. And there's no temple. And we're living in northern Russia. You know, what do we do? You know, we're living in Seattle. You know, how are we going to go to the temple and make sacrifices? They built synagogues, which started in Babylon, and the rabbi became like what the high priest used to be. And so then meetings of rabbis got together and said, gee, what do we do now? So they came up with the idea that if you do good things, it's the same as doing the sacrifices. So that's where the Jewish philanthropy started. You know, give money to hospital, give money to charities, give, you know, work in civil rights, work in the whatever. Takes the place of doing the sacrifices. I mean, Jews don't think that way now, but that's how it started out.
But they are very generous.
And that came around like a 200-300s AD, where they said, well, gee, we can't get rid of our sins anymore. What do we do now? And again, when the temple's gone, it's not like the church got destroyed and you go to another church. It's like you can't do anything now, no matter where you are in the world. I mean, you can take a lamb to the synagogue and say, I brought this lamb in for my sin. And they're going to say, well, that's nice, but you can't do that here. You only do that in the temple. So it's a big problem that we don't have.
What do they do now?
They don't do anything. They do good works. They try to do the law. They say lots of prayers.
They have the Day of Atonement, right?
The Day of Atonement. But they can't do the Day of Atonement. They can only commemorate it because you have to go into there's no Holy of Holies to go into. I mean, it would be like us finding out this afternoon that, you know, God's changed his mind about salvation and the Jesus thing is out now. And in order to be saved, you have to do this other thing, but you can only do it in Bolivia. It'd be like, well, all right, so, let's do 25 through 27.
I do not desire, brother, that you should be ignorant of this mystery, lest you should be wise in your own opinion, that blindness in part has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. And so all Israel will be saved. As it is written, the deliverer will come out of Zion, and he will turn away ungodliness from Jacob. For this is my covenant with them, when I take away their sins.
Whew. So he doesn't want you to be ignorant of this. Don't have your own opinion about it. Israel's temporarily blind. It's not our plan. I don't know why this is the plan. It doesn't sound like a very fair plan. But Israel is temporarily blind until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. You know, that's a term that's thrown around. What does that mean?
Yeah.
So that means the gospel spreads through the Gentiles. So at some point, the very last Gentile going
to
come to Christ, and then the time of the Gentiles is over, and then Israel will be saved. But when the time of the Gentiles is over, it says all Israel will be saved. And it sounds like it's going to be a sudden thing. Now, Zechariah talks about this too, but he talks about it in the sense that they're going to experience the Messiah in some dramatic way. They're going to say, ah, why didn't we get this before? Zechariah comes right out and says it in chapter 12. So it's prophesied in the Old Testament too. Jesus said Jerusalem will be trampled down by Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles is over. Paul adds, you know, until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. So something's going to happen. I mean, this is the time of the Gentiles. Now it's been going on for 2,000 years. We've got 2,000 years of Gentiles. So it's, he says it's a mystery. And he quotes from Isaiah 59. The deliverer will come out of Zion. In other words, the Messiah has to come out of Israel. And he'll turn away ungodliness from Jacob. And what's my covenant with them? I'm going to take away their sins. Now, what covenant did the Jews have? Law. Right? Here's the law. Do the best you can. Oh, by the way, if you violate one, it's the same as violating all of them. Well, maybe I'll get another start at Yom Kippur. Okay, great. Then before Yom Kippur is over, you've done something else. Right? So, how can I do this? So, the covenant, see, he says, the covenant with them is, I'm going to take away their sins. Nowhere in the Torah does it say, I'm just going to take away their sins. You got to answer for everything. Now, all of a sudden, he says, my covenant's going to be, I'm going to take away their sins. Not all of a sudden, back in Isaiah, 700 years before, he says, that's going to be my covenant. Because we're in the new covenant now. If you come to a Seder, you'll see the Last Supper was the transition from the old covenant to the new covenant. Everything changed during that meal. I mean, the cross, of course, but during that meal, everything changed. So instead of the law, you're going to have grace. You're going to get your sin forgiven, even though you're a jerk. Not automatically. I mean, you still have to come. So how cool is that? You know, he says, it's basically, he says, all Israel will be saved. So it's not a permanent rejection. We're going to read one more thing, but let's go through this. Let's do 28 to the end.
Concerning the gospel, they are enemies for your sake. But concerning the election, they are beloved for the sake of the fathers. For the gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable. For as you were once disobedient to God, yet have now obtained mercy through their disobedience, even so, these also have now been disobedient, that through the mercy shown you, they also may obtain mercy. For God has committed them all to disobedience, that he might have mercy on all.
Okay, let's pause there. So, right now, they're the enemies of the gospel. You know, the religious leaders of the time said, if you think Yeshua is the Messiah, you're thrown out of the synagogue. You can't come to the temple anymore. You can't come to the synagogue anymore. You're excommunicated.
Just damnation.
Right, yes. And so we think, like, nobody worries about that anymore either. We're excommunicated, you know. But at this time, if somebody found out, or everybody would immediately know, you know, Joe over here is not allowed to go to the synagogue anymore. He's thrown out. Everybody would go. That would be the end of your social life. That would be the end of your family being accepted. Nobody would come to your store. Nobody would buy your products. Nobody would buy your fish. You would be outcast. And so people had to think twice, do I want to be outcast? And my God, I use the example of Jews for Jesus. These kids get disowned by their parents. So do they like being disowned? No. But now they know the truth. And if you say, well, mom and dad don't like this Jesus stuff, so I better forget the Jesus stuff. I mean, some, I'm not saying 100%. Stay believe. I mean, some people probably run back. I don't know. But generally, no. Because your family can lead you astray, too. So when Jesus says, you know, come with me, and the guy says, oh, I got to go home and He says, well, then you lose. If you go home and talk to your family, they're going to talk you out of it. They're going to lead you in a different direction. So you're not worthy to be my disciple if you're going to run home and tell your parents. You got to come now. He says, the gospel is urgent. You don't have time to go home. So it's a matter of, well, I like the idea. So they're enemies for now, but the gifts and promises of God are irrevocable. He promised them things. He doesn't get rid of the promises. And, you know, he says, see, for their fathers, for the sake of the patriarchs, he doesn't throw them out. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's how he identifies himself. And so they're beloved because of the fathers. And he's not going to go back on his promises. So they're the enemy of the gospel now. But you guys used to be enemies. You guys used to worship Saturn and Jupiter and Apollo and stuff. But now you've gotten grace and mercy. So if you've gotten it, they certainly can get it when they come back, because they were his people to begin with. You guys weren't his people. And you think your average Greek or Roman walked around all day saying, gee, I better brush up on my law thing, because I better go over those laws Moses gave. They could have cared less, right? I don't care what laws the Hindus have, do I? So Israel becomes an enemy of the gospel for the sake of the Gentiles. So the Gentiles got mercy. They can get mercy too. I mean, who can understand these things? So he's committed everybody to disobedience so that he can have mercy on everybody. You know, people say, if Adam hadn't sinned, we wouldn't know what an awesome God we have. Not that he doesn't want you to sin and say, okay, now you even think you're more awesome. But you know what I mean? If everybody was a bunch, you know, if there were 20, you know, if there were 8 billion robots saying, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you, and marching into heaven, you wouldn't know how awesome God is. Compared to if you're a sinner and then you come and you say, wow, I don't deserve any of this, but man, this is awesome. Hey. So then he could hardly stand it anymore. It's okay, now 33 to the end.
Depth of the riches both of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out. For who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has become his counselor, or who has first given to him, and it shall be repaid to him? For of him, and through him, and to him are all things, to whom be glory forever.
Woof! 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 How cool is that? So, again, he breaks into this praise. And being a Pharisee, and this is how we should all be, he quotes a whole bunch of scriptures. He brings all these things out of scripture. You know, the depths and riches, that's Psalm 36:6. We can't figure out his judgments and his mercy. We don't understand how he thinks and how he works. You know, it would be like a grasshopper trying to figure out what we're doing. You know, like an insect has no idea what we're doing here. We can't have any idea how he thinks and how he goes through things or what his plan is. And you say, well, this is unfair. Well, yeah, the grasshopper may think it's unfair if you do something to it, but he's at a totally different level. So we can't even search those things. We can't understand those things. And then he goes to Job. You know, if you read Job, you know, it's quite an ordeal. But in the 30s, I love like 38 and 39 are really good, but you know, God says to Job, you know, were you there when I laid the world out? Were you there? You know, were you my counselor? You know, were you my advisor when I was making stuff? You know, who do you think you are? You know, he can say, I made you. You didn't have anything to do with it. You don't have anything to do with how he made you, right? Your two parents were involved, but you didn't say, well, here's what I want. I want to be blonde. I want to have blue eyes. I want to have hair. I want to be 6 feet tall. I want to be very... No, you don't have a say in how you're made. And if you're born with some birth defect, you can't say, hey, this isn't what I had in mind. So he says, you know, you haven't, and the other thing is, you haven't given God anything that he owes you anything for. Hey, you know what? I said the extra prayer yesterday, so how about a break here? 50 times last year I went to church. That's better than most. No, you don't give him anything that he owes you anything. So he says he can't even stand it, and so he just gives them glory forever and ever. So how cool is that? So that's the end of the Israel chapters.